This is the Lane 9 Podcast, a production of Lane 9 Project, which is a community focused on the intersection of running and disordered eating at all levels of sport. We share your stories, chat with practitioners and coaches, all while working on shifting the norms in sport toward a healthier relationship with food, body, and movement. As one person recently put it in our Lane 9 Project survey, we are, quote, a community that I trust, a community that provides a safer place for those of us that have struggled with food, exercise, and body, a community that gets it. I'm Heather Kaplan, and I'm typically here with my Lane 9 Project co-founder, Alexis Fairbanks, but today I'm chatting with my friend and fellow weight inclusive dietitian, Abby Chan, about recognizing that just because something is considered a norm in any sport, culture, or community doesn't make it healthy or sustainable for any given athlete. This is especially true, of course, with disordered eating patterns and underfueling. So a quick disclaimer. I am a registered dietitian, and I'm chatting with a fellow registered dietitian on this episode. However, we are not your dietitians. Therefore, anything shared in this episode is general, not individual, and shouldn't be considered a replacement for individual medical nutrition therapy or even individual nutrition guidance or advice. Check with your practitioner before making any changes. All right. Hi, Abby.
Hey, thanks, Heather.
Thanks for being here. We've done so many podcasts together, so whatever number this is, I don't know, but thanks for joining me.
I'm so excited to be here. I always love podcasting with you and just chatting with you, so it's great.
I'm so glad. Yeah, we spent a good deal of time just chatting, and we need to hop to it here. So I want to start with your sports story. You have worked as a group fitness instructor for a very long time, like pre-college even, and you're also a certified registered dietitian, and you own a gym now with your spouse to, quote, help the Flagstaff community feel, eat, and perform their best. So take us way back. How did you get into sports as a kid? What was your favorite sport, and how did it evolve from there?
Yeah, as a kid, oh gosh, I'm going to totally out myself here. One of my dreams as a kid was becoming a triple threat, if you know what that is. So embarrassing. Singer, dancer, actor. I became only one of those things. Dancer. And
there is still time.
There is no time for these vocal cords ever. But I love dancing. Dancing was always something that was a big part of my life growing up. I started dancing when I was a little tiny. And from there, it was more recreational, fun type things. And at one point, my dad was like, I think you need to do something else too. He just needed to keep me busy. He was a single dad and just needed to occupy all of our time. Yeah. And so he put me in tennis lessons, which is where I found one of my still best friends. We were in tennis lessons together. That's how we met each other. So did that and then started, well, living in Flagstaff, growing up in Flagstaff, and now it's where I currently live, which we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. It's a big, just outdoor community. It's a mountain town. So I grew up biking. That was like a mode of transportation. It was also something fun that we did. We had a pump track in our backyard that my brother and I built. So that was a fun thing. And then also started climbing when I was, 12-ish or something around there. Yeah. And dance was my main sport. And I was a competitive dancer all the way through high school. And I still dance. It's still a part of my life and I love it. It's always been a massive way that I can find an emotional release, or if I don't have the words for something, at least I can move it through my body space, which is really important. And I didn't actually realize that's what it was and when I was little and through my adolescent years, but that's now reflecting back, I'm like, oh, that's why I love it so much. Yeah. So that was also where I started teaching. So I was also a dance teacher. I think I started like 15, 16, to little ones. And that was really fun as well. But also in high school, that was when I really, like middle school, high school is also when I really started kind of going down the disordered eating, eating disorder pipeline roller coaster. And that was also where running came in. So running became a additional kind of side dish to becoming a good dancer, right? At the time, it wasn't really body image focused. And I would say from an eating disorder perspective, it was never, I want to change my body, so I will do X, Y, and Z. And now knowing what I know and working in the spaces that I work, I'm like, oh, this is totally a regulation tool. This is the only way your body knew how to feel safe. And that makes sense. And so through high school, pretty undernourished, dancing an extreme amount, far too many training hours for any adolescent body, for sure. And I would run. I would run, I would do stairs at our stadium. And then I would run just around just to get miles in and just to clear my head, and thought that was like totally normal to be doing all of these things at the same time. And then I was also a little bit of a problem kid. My dad would also agree. And so I got grounded from basically everything. I was grounded most of my high school career. And so he started to have to take things away. So he took my phone away, classic things, took my car away, took dance away. And at that point, I was like, well, running and biking have been a way that I can get around. So I started actually using running as transportation. So I would just run to the mall and meet my friends and run home, or like run to the movies. And I eventually got my running shoes taken away. So yeah.
Okay, there's like so much we could dig into there, but
there's so much in there.
And then, now's not the time. So I didn't have that background. Like, I feel like I know, I obviously don't know everything about you, but I feel like I know a lot. And I did not have that context of running at that time in your life. So I knew that like dance has been big for you for a long time, but those are fun little tidbits.
Totally. There's always more in here.
Always more, yes.
There's always more. I was listening to the maybe first or second, whatever, when you just relaunched Lane 9, in the two episodes, talking about, you know, distance running in college. Like, yeah. I was like, yeah, that is weird to do. And I was like, and I did that. Like, I ran my first half in college with that best friend that I met in tennis. And it was horrible. I again, just like you, like didn't train, didn't know what I was doing, still really struggling with my relationship to food, had an extreme amount of injuries also when I was in high school, like stress fractures, all the things, low iron, like I could basically just like sleep in the dance studio and that would be fine with me. Yeah, so pretty problematic there. And then since then, like aerial and dance, so aerial arts and dance have been a big part of my life, mountain biking as well. And running, again, as just really a mode of transportation. I have an issue, and this is something I probably need to unpack, and this is also part of living in Flagstaff, of I've never wanted the identity of a runner because it's just a thing here. Yeah. It's something that I enjoy doing, but like I don't want people to like make all these assumptions about me and who I am and what I do and all of that. So I don't consider myself a quote unquote runner necessarily. I enjoy doing it and it's really fun. And it's always been a way, especially in my adult life, that I prefer to explore things. So if I can't bike there, I don't mind hiking. It's fine, but my hands get really swollen. So I'd rather run. Yeah. So I'd rather just run somewhere if possible. Yeah. And so it's been ways that, you know, I get to experience the Southwest. So like, I love being in Grand Canyon. And so that's a place where it's like, all right, I want to go see the river. You know, I could hike down there easily, not easily, but I could hike down there, or I could run and then it's a little bit faster. So
just more efficient, for being honest. Yeah.
Just more efficient. Yeah. It's just faster. I can like come back home and it's fine.
Yeah. Okay. When did you decide to study nutrition? Because you were already pretty immersed in the fitness space. How did nutrition come into that in college?
Well, we seek the knowledge for what we're trying to do to fix ourselves. And yeah, so I started, many of us. So I started as a business major in school because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And when your whole family's in business and entrepreneurship, you're like, great, that's what I'll do. Yeah. Business school doesn't teach you anything about that. And I switched my major after my first year because it was miserable. And then I also took that year off. I think we talked about this before too, but I lost my brother after my freshman year of college. And that was a big, obviously, like come inside time and ground back in, figure out what we want to do when your whole world is just shifted upside down. It's like a big reality check. So I knew that I was at Arizona State, and so I came back, and I knew that I didn't want to stop going to school because I had a fear. This is also like Asian culture, like Chinese culture and hustle culture in the US and everything. But I had a big fear of like, if I stop doing this, what if I never go back? And I knew that I had to take some sort of science classes for whatever I ended up doing. And so I was like, I'll just, you know, do this at community college. And that was where I figured out that I actually loved science, and it was really cool. And I was actually pretty good at it. And then I took a nutrition 101 class, and I didn't even know that you could be a dietitian or that was an option. And that's where I figured it out. So I switched my major and became a dietitian, or eventually became a dietitian. Yeah.
And on that day, I was then a dietitian. No,
I was then an RD.
Yeah. Okay. So you studied nutrition in college, meanwhile had your own disordered relationship with food. Who relates? I'm going to raise my hand. Many of us.
I'm sure everyone is raising their hands.
So many people. What eventually drew you into sports nutrition? Like, was, I feel like some people have the attitude of like, I'm going to keep my hobbies my hobby and my work my work. And then there's a lot of us who are like, I'm going to overlap them all the time.
I will be working and hobbying all day.
All day, every day. Yes.
Yes. That's a great question. I think because I've always loved being in movement. I've always loved that as an expression, as a aspect of life. I'm fascinated with it from a perspective of, you know, humans' innate need and want to move in some way, shape, or form. It does not have to be running. It does not have to be intentional movement, but whatever that is, I'm really fascinated by that. And because I struggled so much and was still struggling at that time, I think I was, yeah, just trying to figure out, how do I fix myself? So that was probably what it was. I don't think there was ever like a bold moment, but I also at that point, you know, I feel like in dietetics, rather like, I want to be clinical, or I want to like work for a sports team. And then I was like, I want to work for a sports team. And then I realized, no shade to any dietitians who work on sports teams. I think y'all are great and amazing. But I was like, I don't want to be your team mom and make you snacks and do all that. That just feels like too much for me. And I'd rather, and they do a lot of science and they do a lot of really important things, but yeah. I did not want to be a mom to a team of 60 to 100 people or whatever that is. I don't know.
A lot of people.
And yeah, just a lot of people. And depending on what university or professional team you're at, it's just a lot that's going on. And I was never really into ball sports. That's never been a thing. And that's the only way you can be a sports dietitian in that realm. And so I wanted to find a different path that like, okay, bodies and movement do need nutrition outside of daily life. And I think that that's a really important aspect. And this is the world, like the worlds I also coexist in. So it just kind of became a natural shift. And through nutrition, we've probably talked about this before on a podcast at a time, but through nutrition didactic programming, you've realized, well, I realized, and a lot of us realized, of like, you're telling me to do all the things that I know are really unhealthy for me, for most people to be quote unquote healthy. And so that's also really when I started questioning a lot of the just ways that having a weight-centric approach to nutrition is really problematic, and prescribing disordered eating to clients is really problematic, especially from a, you know, mental, emotional, cultural, so many lenses, all of that. And so that was how I started kind of that path into looking at how to think about nutrition differently.
Yeah. Now. Okay. Can you give us a quick pitch on your nutrition ethos, or like the foundations of how you practice with athletes? You just started touching on that a little bit and we haven't described that yet.
Yeah. So from an athletic standpoint, I think most people think there's daily nutrition and just being quote unquote healthy or whatever that is, or it's eating disorder specific, or it's sport specific. And I'm like, everyone who's existing in any of these camps is a human, first and foremost. And we need to look at all of these aspects of how you are relating and connecting with food and your body. And most of these spaces are obviously pretty fraught for just really unhelpful information. And so I kind of started to bring all those together. And whether you're an athlete or someone who is not an athlete and just enjoys living your life and whatnot, we're going to be starting from the same places, looking at the basics of your nutrition, your nutrition behaviors, your relationship with food. So that's typically where I always start, of what's your relationship to food, movement, your body, outside of sports, because that is what everyone wants to jump to first and foremost. If we're looking at like a pyramid type thing, it's like, we can't just start at the top. We can't just start at looking at, you know, your fueling plan for your race and for your training sessions. We need to be looking at you as a whole human existing in the world.
Yeah. Okay. So
that was not an elevator pitch. Sorry.
We're not good at elevator pitches. They're really hard. You live in Flagstaff, which, as you mentioned earlier, is a mountain town, and I would say holds many identities, like a little crunchy. It's in Arizona, so there is like desert nearby, but Flagstaff itself feels really different than the rest of the state, at least as I perceive it. And so when people think of Flagstaff now, I think they are starting to associate it really strongly with an endurance athlete hub, like long distance runners, middle distance runners, like competitive runners are just flocking to Flagstaff. And it sounds like even before that, there was already sort of an ethos in the city of like, we are active, we are outdoors, we are quote unquote healthy. Those are the things people maybe would put onto their own identity as like someone who lives in that area. And then you have this influx of athletes and like really high level athletes. How has that shifted what you see in your clientele at the gym, or just even in your own community as somebody who lives there and has for a long time?
Yeah, Flagstaff's a lot. Flagstaff's great and it's a lot. It did definitely start off as, yeah, this like kind of tiny, sleepy mountain town. We have a lot of trees. It snows. We have all four seasons. And because we are the most populous city in Arizona, like at this elevation, I always joke that Phoenix and Tucson will always be hot. So people will always find refuge. So there's always been that aspect to where it's high elevation. You can easily drop down 2,000 feet in 30 minutes and be in the desert, and you can in an hour be in Grand Canyon. Like there's just so much around us. And so, yeah, it definitely started as like a ski, bike, climb, hike, whatever community. With that inherently, especially being a little bit more hippie and crunchy, there's that food package that comes with it. So a lot of orthorexia at baseline in general. So, you know, an obsession with clean, healthy, organic before we even had those words, like way back in the 90s, you know, we still had multiple like quote unquote health food stores here. And then the intersection of once people started finding that Flagstaff is, oh, this is at 7,000 feet. So I can live high and train high, but also train low if I want to. And I can do that in 30 to 45 minutes. So people started really gravitating towards Flagstaff for that reason, as well as the fact that it, you know, we're, I don't even know our population, 65, 70 something thousand people. So it's also somewhat populous, and we have, you know, actual medical facilities. We have a level one trauma center. We have restaurants. We have culture. We have a university. So it's a small town, but there's a lot of offerings there. So I think people can work. There's a lot of runners that will move here and, you know, kind of pick up odd jobs in their free time. And so there's a lot of space to do that, which is great. But since that intersection, you know, we come in with this orthorexic baseline, and then we throw a bunch of running volume on that and intensity, and it's just boom.
Yeah.
People are falling apart. Not everyone. Not everyone, but.
A really good example that you gave when we were catching up before we started recording was that you might have somebody come in and say, because your husband is a physical therapist. And so the gym offers like many different services, physical therapy, meal planning, one-on-one nutrition service, personal training, group classes. What am I missing? Acupuncture.
We have acupuncture. Yeah. And I think too, like an important aspect is we do this all under like a weight inclusive non-diet lens, you know? So yeah. I think that's a important difference, because you all of these things can look the same and maybe two different facilities, but the approach is actually very different. So, but my husband's a physical therapist and so we work with a lot of injuries.
So you might have somebody come in and say, I have a hip injury, for example, and you start kind of like, okay, let's get your history, your injury history, your, you know, current behavioral patterns. How often are you running? How much are you eating, et cetera? And they might say something like, oh, I don't run that much, only 30 miles a week. But like anywhere else, like I've said that to a practitioner, I will say like, oh, I maybe run, if I'm training for something, maybe 25 to 30 miles a week. And they're like, whoa. I'm like, I know, it sounds like a lot if you're not in the running space. And maybe it is a lot. And I'm jaded as well because I've been in the endurance space for a long time. But to say that and like consider what an elite athlete down the street, your neighbor or whatever, is doing, it definitely like shifts a lot of how we think of what is normal or what is quote unquote healthy, because the dynamic of the city has shifted, right? Or the dynamic of like the active community has shifted. And this is not to say anything bad about the athletes that are there. I just think that there is a really common thing that happens in the running space where we have so much access to elite athletes now, and we see their training on Strava, and we see their days on Instagram, and we hear their podcast interview. Like, we just have so much information, and it's shifting what we might consider normal. And that's also happening at a community level for you, right?
For sure. And I think it's interesting and it's nuanced, right? Like, part of this is really, A, from an athlete standpoint, really vulnerable. It's like we see people, you know, it's like even before the Olympic trials, it's like you saw people like, I am dropping out due to injury, or I can't do this. And it's like, gosh, you have to be an athlete and have to be having trained for this, you know, your whole life, and then have to go on and tell all of your followers, like, I can't do this. Like, oh, it's just extreme. And I think there's the flip side of that too, where it's, perpetuating that quote unquote sense of normalcy of big high volumes and big intensity and like all of the, like, you know, fastest known times and breaking records. Like, I think that does set up this platform of everyone thinking I should be doing this. So it shifts a lot of people's perspective of, yes, what is normal? What is enough? What's a lot of volume? What's intensity? And I think it's always reframing that for people of like, well, what is it for you? For someone that may not be a lot.
Yeah.
But then we need to look at too, how is your identity wrapped up in this? If you are coming in with an injury or eating disorder or disordered eating, like, we need to really do a reality check on, is your worldview so warped that you think that that is normal and that is okay, and that's okay for your body, because it sounds like we may not be able to listen to it. I think one flip side of the fact that we have so much access to all this information is kind of cool, because it is pushing human boundaries.
Yeah.
Again, but realizing sort of that, yeah, it takes a lot to get there, and you don't have to do that if you don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, like, even at the really high levels and people who do this and have a lot of support in their corner and a lot of resources at their fingertips are still having to kind of reckon with like what is sustainable for them and what is quote unquote healthy for them as an athlete to stay in the sport as a high level competitor, if that's what they want to do.
Yep. And I think that my most at-risk population is the recreational athlete, like the recreational competitive athlete, right? So the one who is working a full-time job, the one who has a family, and then the one who's then throwing on big volumes on top of that and having to squeeze it in the morning before the kids get up, or late in the evening, and or then it's disrupting sleep, or both. And I think it's so big that that population is so at risk because they don't have support, they don't have other people watching out. Like, they may have a running coach, and depending on that coach is going to be variable on what they're looking out for and what their knowledge base is on what is enough, what is too much, what is stress on the body. So I think it's just really challenging because people see that, oh, this is now the norm, therefore I should be chasing that norm, without realizing the entire swath of individuals that's surrounding these professional athletes.
Right.
And all of the resources.
like, not to be too trite, but like everything you don't see on social media. Because even if we know in our silly little brains that we're seeing a tiny sliver, our brains convince us otherwise all the time that this is like 90% of the picture and it's like 1% of the picture.
Yeah, they're not going to be like sharing a story of like, I'm going to see my dietitian, I'm going to see my PT, I'm going to see, you know, my sports med doctor, I'm going to like do all of these things. No, that doesn't exist. Yeah. That's not exciting. You know, people don't want to see that. And so I think that would be cool, but you know, I'm different.
Also, like, you don't have to update us with like every 5 minutes of your life, but yeah,
it's extreme.
We fill in the gaps because our brains have just shifted in chemistry to start doing that. And it's really wild. So let's say you said your most at-risk client is a recreational runner who's squeezing it in and has all these other things going on, which many, if not most of us do, right? Like the percentage of humans who are high-level elite athletes is very, very tiny. So what are some things that you might start with that client? Like say that that's a person who is walking into your office today, has a stress fracture, is training for a marathon, is eating quote unquote clean, organic, you know, like following something that they saw on Instagram. Like we all know what this looks like. What are some things that you might start with?
Yeah. So first and foremost, again, no matter whoever you are, I'm going to ask about, you know, what is your relationship to food? What is your relationship to sport? What does your training volume look like? And really start to ask the tough questions around what are your beliefs around food? If it is clean eating, I'm going to dig into that one a little bit. Yeah. And I think people will often come up, you know, I want to have a fueling plan, you know, and a training plan. And I'm like, cool. You're also like a human 85 to 90% of your day. So let's talk about that first. So, yeah. Most people want that like top tier level, you know, how many grams of carbs per hour from on this amount of thing and sodium. And that's helpful and that's necessary.
Yeah.
But we need to think about you as the 90% of you and fuel the 90% of you, which is the human in you. And so I'm always coming from a place of adding food. I have, there's another running coach in town who, we work together a lot and there's a lot of athletes and they're like, I don't think I've ever had an athlete who isn't eating more when they leave your office. I'm like, yeah, that's the point because no one's eating enough ever.
Ever. Nobody.
Ever. Yeah. So it's coming from, can we first and foremost get enough like calories, nutrients in you? Mm-hmm. Because also if you're in a really disordered space, we can't actually intervene very well and start to unlearn some of these like clean, other big air quote things that I won't even say because it's irrelevant. That we can't actually start to unlearn those things and work on those things until we're actually eating enough and our brain is nourished enough and our body is able to be more regulated.
Yeah.
I think that's the tricky intersection too, of if it's just eating disorder or disordered eating and not high volume athlete on top of it, then not that that's easy to work with, but when we have the intersection of the two, it's super hairy and it takes a long time. And a lot of people aren't ready for that and ready to have to possibly take a pretty big step back in their training.
Yeah. And to just like bring back everything we've talked about up to this point is like those behavior patterns and belief systems come from many, many places and have roots in like many parts of our lives, our communities, our friends, our hobbies, our workplaces, our family culture. You know, like it's not as simple as just leaving your office and being like, I'm just going to eat more because Abby told me to. Like, then you go to your group run and people are talking about their diets, or you go to your office and, you know, it's like, it's so pervasive. It's everywhere. And it's especially prevalent in our like running spaces. And even though those running spaces can give so much to us in terms of community, friendship, movement, self-expression, self-challenge, etc. That doesn't mean it's all good.
No, definitely not. It definitely doesn't mean it's all good. And I think that's the tricky part of it because we can totally unpack something and make a lot of strides in unlearning some of these things. And it could be one comment from a coach, it could be one comment from someone on a group run, it could be one little thing that is going to relearn whatever we just unlearned. And we kind of have to gently start that process again. So there's a lot of reflection that goes into it. I often have people leaving my office with journal prompts or things to think about, not like here's what to eat, but it's like here's what we need to be thinking about of what are we surrounding ourselves with, and how are we engaging in that, and then what is our action from that thought process too.
Okay, we're definitely going to leave people today with some journal prompts. So we'll come back to that, put a pin in there. What happens after these folks leave your office and they're eating more and they're still running and working with their coach?
Well, it depends on what it is. A lot of times it goes really well. If they're doing, all of a sudden they're like, oh my gosh, like I'm sleeping better. I think there's so many gastrointestinal related things with especially low energy availability, with red S, and athletes don't understand that. And they don't understand the intersection of that. And they're like, what do I need to cut out? And I'm like, well, actually, that's not what we're gonna do. And so it's like their gut feels better. They're sleeping. They have power in their training. They're not trashed on after their long runs. Like they could do something if they wanted to. They don't have to be on the couch for the rest of the day and zombie to the rest of the world. So I think it's really cool, but it is that huge level of trust. And a lot of athletes, I'm like, how do we feel about this? Like this is a lot to digest. This probably wasn't fully what you're expecting coming into me because most people think
Literally
dietitians are the
and
food police.
figuratively.
Yeah, I'm like, this wasn't most likely what you're expecting. How does this feel and what feels scary about it? Because I think that's important to recognize if it's not so easy, just like, great, cool, like here's the things I'm working on. I'm just gonna do it and tie the little bow and it's gonna be perfect. It's like, this is gonna be hard because I am going against most likely everything you've been told, everything you absorb, everything that you see around you, and that doesn't make what you're doing easy.
I'm curious for you as someone who is an athlete, however, I don't know if you identify, like I think of you as an athlete, but like a dancer, a yoga teacher, a runner, a mountain biker, like when you enter those spaces or you might find new groups, like I know you do a lot with Shredly, is am I saying that right? Okay, Shredly, which is a brand or company that makes cycling gear, and you do classes and you participate in these communities in a lot of ways. Like, how do you navigate that for yourself, going in and knowing what a lot of the norms are and like the prevalence of disordered behaviors and movement patterns in these active communities? Like, how do you navigate that for you?
I am lucky that I'm stubborn and outspoken, and I don't care. I do care. I really love people. I care about people, but I'm not afraid to call things out. And I think for a lot of people, that's really scary, because you're putting your acceptance, your self-acceptance, which is, in our needs, in our basic human needs of having that aspect of validation of like you're putting that out there and putting it on the line. So I think that's one thing that I have in my favor. I don't know where it came from. Probably my grandma. She's also outspoken. But I mean, I'm not afraid to call things out. And I think not that I have a huge platform by any means, but when I am in these spaces, I think people who are around me or maybe follow me, like they know what I'm about. I am not hiding it. They know exactly what I'm talking about. They know how I feel about these things. And I will often, if there is a comment around food or movement or even, bodies and body image and things like that, like I will call it out and I will, put my RD hat on right then and there because all of these aspects matter. And I think when, and this is something I've taken on because this is what I do for a career, but it's like the more that I fragment myself, if I shapeshift of like, this is my dietitian hat and this is my athlete hat and this is whatever else I'm doing. If I have all these different identities, I'm also not being true to myself. And so if I don't call those out, I feel like I'm doing a disservice not only to me and myself and my relationship with food and my recovery, and it's also not doing them a service either. Because it will be perpetuated.
I love that. Got some hard boundaries. We love a hard boundary. All right. Our audience is either currently navigating disordered eating, disordered relationship to food and movement, or they have in the past, or some combination of both. What are some words or prompts maybe that you want to leave them with?
Yeah, one thing. Well, a few things. One of them is, especially if you are really struggling with an eating disorder or your relationship to food, feeding your body in general in and outside of training, and say you are injured or you're not injured yet because, hey, congratulations, your body's really good at surviving. maybe whatever that looks like, if you're struggling in any fashion, I think you get caught up in the hustle of what if I lose my community? If I take this time off, what will happen to my training plan, my training year? And I always, and this is part of like the social media hustle where, you know, this person's doing this race and this is person's doing this. I think we get so caught up. And if I'm not doing that, then it's not okay. But in order to heal and recover, we actually have to reel it back a lot. We have to reel a lot of training back. So again, from an injury perspective, that could be months. And if we don't do that, we end up potentially injuring our bodies for the rest of our lives. And so I really like to have people take a moment where it's like, this could be a few really hard months, maybe a year, to get us into a healthy space. But I want to know what you want to be doing when you're 75 and 80, because that's the thing that matters. And that's really hard to do when you have your whole race season planned out. But it's the essential thing. So zooming out and figuring out, especially if this isn't your job, why are you breaking your body to do it?
Yay, we love that. Especially if this isn't your job. Okay, we have two questions from Instagram that maybe we can answer to some extent, maybe we can't. They're pretty specific. So we're going to go for it and see what happens. Can, quote, mild underfueling and overtraining, unquote, cause slow nerve healing? This was a question put into a really specific context for like a post LASIK surgery runner. That's a super specific instance, but in general, could mild underfueling, whatever that might mean, and overtraining cause slow nerve healing? Question mark.
Take the stage. Yeah. I have a lot of nuance in most things in my world, but when it comes to mild underfueling, air quotes, yeah, or a little bit of underfeeling, you're either fueled or you're not. And taking that with a grain of salt, where it's like, not every day is going to be exactly perfect. You may get busy and whatnot, but mild underfeeling means that you're in a low energy available state. So that is what it is, which means our bones aren't going to heal, our muscles aren't going to heal, our tendons, our ligaments, our organs and essential organs aren't going to have enough energy to just function at baseline. And so then when we throw injury, any sort of stress on the body from surgery, anything on top of it, yeah, it's going to impact the healing process. I'm not an ophthalmology dietitian.
What?
Weird. But we can, you know, expand and take some of those concepts to the eyes as well. And LASIK, from my understanding, only because my husband's had PRK, LASIK, I hear, is a little bit easier from a quote unquote, from a recovery standpoint, quote unquote, easier. PRK is much more intensive, to where you are out for a long period of time and you do have to be really careful and you can't stress your body out. But if you're having a slow healing process with anything, then yeah, you are probably not eating enough and giving your body the basic things that it needs to function and recover.
Yeah, I think generally, if you're not healing on what might be like an average timeline, I know that can be sort of a loaded word, but like if anything feels sort of delayed, or in this case, using the descriptor slow to you or your practitioner, that's always going to be an opportunity to zoom out and see like, what are there any things that I could do to help my body navigate this? And is there anything I am doing that's working against it? And like, maybe yes, maybe no. But in this case, the question being, could mild underfueling and overtraining cause or impact nerve healing? Yes.
Yeah.
TLDR, yes.
TLDR, yes. Yeah. And I think that's one thing, even if we have now like multiple PTs on staff or even our trainers on staff where it's like, even if they're not a quote unquote athlete, right? If they are having, again, those prolonged healing times for any sort of injury, then it's typically going to be a referral to me or one of our dietitians saying, hey, like, what I'm seeing here isn't quote normal from what I should be seeing. Yeah. What else do we need to be looking at? You know, athlete or not, I think we also forget that most humans underfuel themselves. So undernourish. Yeah.
Next question. How could I tell if I'm having hypothalamic or lactational amenorrhea 2 years postpartum? So just pausing to quickly define what both of those things might mean. Hypothalamic amenorrhea is irregular or absent menstrual cycles due to low energy availability. Could be underfueling, could be overexercising, usually both. Lactational amenorrhea is somebody who is nursing or lactating, and that often changes our hormonal balances, our hormonal production to support milk production and suppress menstrual cycles or menstrual like ovulating. So, you know, the theory or I guess biological reason being that if you have a baby that you're nursing, you probably don't want to have another one. But sometimes that still happens. Anyway, so if 2 years postpartum, and there is really no way for us to answer this question because there are so many questions that would follow that up, right? I wanted to put it here just to highlight that we kind of use amenorrhea as a shorthand for hypothalamic amenorrhea, but there are lots of reasons that somebody might have amenorrhea. If you're pregnant, you are amenorrheic. You're not having menstrual cycles because you're pregnant. So there are different things that could impact. There are so many things that impact our menstrual cycle and whether or not we're getting regular cycles or ovulating regularly. And in this case, I would say this just prompts a lot of other questions for me to try to decipher if it's one or the other. And just very, very generally, I don't think it's that common to see lactational amenorrhea 2 years postpartum, because usually with a two-year-old, you might be nursing a couple times a day, but they're getting most of their nutrition outside of breast milk. So compare that to a newborn or even up to 12 months, they're getting the majority of their nutrition from breast milk or formula. So I would be surprised personally if somebody was still amenorrheic lactating 2 years postpartum, but it is certainly not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I'd say it's not out of the realm of possibility, but I would also say that, especially from that nutritional component of, yeah, how concentrated is the milk? What nutrients are in there? There's going to be less pulling from your body, but it is still a stress on your body. But, and even if that was the, say, primary reason, if we could just isolate everything else, and if it was, then that tells me that there could be something again. Well, I guess this goes into the overall amenorrhea standpoint of like, if your body can't support it, then it's going to be problematic. Granted, that would be more from the low energy availability standpoint. But I would say that depending on what your training looked like during your pregnancy, also afterwards, how much of a low energy available state you went in through those kind of now 3 years, it sounds like to me it could be definitely both, but I would say most likely the aspect would be from a low energy available state to where our body can't start to normalize and regulate again. Mm. But again, it's going to be dependent on what's your hormonal history? What other reproductive things you have going on? There's so many factors, but I would say the easiest low-cost intervention without getting labs and making appointments and doing all these different things would be to let's maybe pull back a little bit on training and eat a little bit more and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We have some last lap questions, if you will. These are short answer questions. They're just for fun. Take them or leave them. You can pass if you want. Okay. If you could have one song played along the course during the final mile or lap of a race, or for you, the last 5 minutes of your run, wherever you happen to be running, what do you pick?
Oh my gosh. My brain is a Spotify melting pot. And I don't know. It has ruined me because I have so many favorite songs and so many playlists. And I love music so much that I couldn't choose MGMT. Time to Pretend. It would be that
one. Ooh, MGMT. Love that. Okay, this is going to derail us a little bit, but recently had a weekend with friends. One of our friends created this trivia game a la like the Friends episode where they're playing the game that Ross made, right? Somebody made it. Anyways, one of our assignments pre-weekend so that she could put this together was to send in our two guilty pleasure songs. And this assignment unraveled me. I was like, well, what do you mean? Like all-time favorite song, a song I feel weird about liking, an artist I feel weird about liking. Like, I don't feel guilty about any of the songs I like. I just like them all. I was just like, I cannot select two songs. Like, this is impossible. I cannot complete this assignment. And everyone was like, oh my God, it's not that hard. Just pick two songs that you like. I was like, but I don't feel guilty. I couldn't do it.
Really, that may even be like dietitian, how to like guilt. Why would like, I don't feel bad about it.
I don't like the wording, I think is the problem. I don't feel guilty about liking any of these songs. I just like them. One of the songs that I went with, just to out myself, is Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke.
Yes.
Which I think pretty much fit the bill. I think that was my understanding of the assignment. I was like, hate to admit this, it's a damn bop. Okay, anyways, do you prefer group runs or solo runs and why?
I prefer friend runs and solo, both. I don't know. So I have actually never been a part of like a running club or a big running group. I love to do small runs with like, you know, with 2 to 3 friends, something like that. One of my like intentions, and specifically right now in a training phase, I'm like, the whole reason why I'm doing this is to be in community, to have fun, and to really take care of my body. So a lot of that is right now with my partner. So it's like conversation pace, and we get to be out and hang out together. And that's really fun. A lot of times, and this is again, the stupid ego thing of bike staff. It's like, oh, well, I don't want to run with you because I'm not sure if I'm that fast. I'm like, I don't care. I'm just here to hang out with you. And I want to talk to you. And we're probably going to look at flowers and we're going to eat snacks and it's fine. And like, I have no agenda. I'm just here to be here.
That's a pretty universal thing. Cause I have run in many cities with many friends, and there is always the, like, I don't know if I can keep up with you comment. Whether that's coming from me to the other person or the other person to me. And I'm always like, my first goal here is to run with you. So I don't care what that means. And I hope that that goes both ways. I hope that if we're deciding to run together, it's so that we can run together, not so that one of us can see if we can keep up, because that's not fun.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think I like both, but I also really love a solo run. Sometimes, you know, I don't know. There's this at level sometimes that we get to, or distance. I don't know if you can hear my dogs. I'm sorry. You know, it's like, I call them like a cry run, where it's like, you're just like, have your AirPods in and everything is great. And your favorite song comes on and you're like, the world is amazing. And so I only have those moments often alone, so I love both of them.
Yeah, I totally get that. Very relatable. Next question. What running item or brand should sponsor you because you're constantly singing their praises to your friends or clients?
Honestly, most of the things I'm referring or giving to my clients is a bunch of sports-specific nutrition things. So Scratch, holler if you want to hang out. Love your stuff. It's great. I do get fun things from them sometimes, which is awesome. Yeah. I was a Lululemon ambassador for a long time, so I have a lot of Lululemon, still love a lot of Lululemon. And I really love my new Asics running shoes, surprisingly.
All right. If you see Abby on the trails in Flagstaff, she's wearing Asics, Lululemon, and she's got some Scratch in her hand. So, you know.
And high chews in my pocket. So if you need a high chew, if you need candy, let me know.
Snacks. She's got snacks. Okay. Last one. What's a running moment that you feel deeply proud of or that stands out to you for any reason?
I would say the first time I ran in Grand Canyon. That was obviously a big elevation, lots of elevation. It's hot. It's all the things. It's a lot. I think it's a dream for a lot of people for who are in the trail running community to be able to run in a space like that. And I think the first time that I was able to, I felt really good and I felt really accomplished. And it's a place that I just have this huge heart pull to all the time. So I would say that that's definitely where I like happy laugh cry, even if I am with people there, just because I freaking love it so much.
Yeah. It's very mind bendy. You sort of look around and you're like, is this real? I don't know if this is real. How did
exactly.
I get here?
So many layers in there.
So many layers. All right. Awesome. Thank you for being here, Abby. Where can folks find you if they want to work with you, follow you, or both?
You can find me at AbbyTheRD on all of the socials. I'm most active on Instagram. And you can find me and Evolve at, you can find me and my business Evolve at evolveflg.com. We can do a variety of things, whether it be, again, working with me from a nutrition perspective or a nutrition perspective. It could be injury related things. It could also be, you know, training things, strength training. I think that's one thing that a lot of runners, I think, are picking up on now that it's really important, especially in an endurance space, but is essential from a, you know, just injury reduction space.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.